Welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters is a program that examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking to mitigate reckless and destructive development. This program aims to increase your ecological intelligence, to encourage you to think globally, act locally, and to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. I'm speaking with Nathan Vadaboncour, president and founder of Smart Shores. Welcome to Earth Matters, Nathan. Tell us a little bit about what Smart Shores does.
Thanks for having me. Smart Shores is a company that is trying to help people who are working to conserve the environment to save time and do more. So what we do is we offer drone data collection, processing, and some software tools to help people get data and make sense of it faster so they can put all that people, time, and resources into helping make the planet better rather than sorting through big spreadsheets.
Okay, so rather than looking at reams and reams of data that have been collected by researchers, you send up a drone, it analyzes what it's looking at, so it's not just pretty pictures, you're looking at what's beneath the surface of either the soil or the water, and that allows organizations to make better choices and quicker. Is that correct?
Well, we do a combination of things. One is we produce different types of maps, so orthophotos, which are digital maps with geographic coordinates, like pictures. We have digital elevation models, which shows how the elevation and surface of the land changes. And then we provide different types of value-added analysis tools. So we can take data, say, where from the ground where different pollutants were measured, and connect those dots to show how contaminants are dispersed within a site. We can look at how many trees there are in a given area, how tall they are, how wide the trunks are, and try and estimate how much carbon they're sequestering or how much they could be worth in a forestry operation, things like that.
Okay, so that's quite a lot of data that you can gather. Give me an idea how you got your start in this, and was it a GIS or was it a mapping? Was it a sense of environmentalism? Where did you get your start?
I was working as a consultant and as someone working in science assessment for the Canadian federal government. And part of this involved talking to a lot of people and understanding what data they got, what they used it for, and what they need. And one of the things that was consistent across the board, no matter who I was talking to, no matter where they were, was that we need more data and we need better data, but it's too expensive. And right around the same time, drones were coming on the market at a high quality for this kind of prosumer level drone. And there was a real opportunity, I think, to take the type of data that drones can produce and develop tools to tailor that specifically to environmental management. So I started doing a little bit of work in that field, and it started to snowball. And then I left consulting, and now I full-time support environmental groups getting and making the most of the data with drones.
Okay. And do you work exclusively with environmental groups?
I work with environmental groups and with local governments right now. So we work a lot with Ducks Unlimited here in British Columbia. We've done stuff for the West Coast Conservation Lands Management Society. And right now we have a project going on that is working with both those groups and with the city of Surrey on a coastal flood adaptation project. Mm-hmm. So we work with people who have an interest in managing sensitive environmental sites. And these are usually in places where people live, because people would come to an estuary because there was a place to catch fish. There was nice flat land and fertile soil to farm. There's a river to transport logs and people down. And so we usually have municipalities and industry and environmental interests all in around these critical areas that are also low-lying and prone to flood. So there's any kind of actor that's interested in how the environment may affect them, or how they may affect the environment for one way or another, is the kind of people that we work with.
So let's drill down a little bit. You're not just taking pictures of what's beneath the drone. As you say, either you're looking at marshlands, coastal areas, that kind of thing. So what is the guts of what you're working with? Have you got proprietary software that analyzes things, or are there monitors that are on the drone? What, give me an idea what what's the drone is carrying.
Yeah, so our proprietary stuff is software, but to start, we'll start at the drone for how we get there. So there's two ways we collect data that our software uses. One is with a drone that's got nothing but GPS and a camera, and we do something called photogrammetry, which is the art and science of taking measurements from pictures. So we'll fly the drone at a constant altitude, the camera will point straight down, and we'll take a lot of overlapping pictures by flying in a grid. Since these pictures are overlapping, we can take these stereo image pairs, which are two pictures of the same thing, slightly offset, so all the angles on the ground change. And from that, we can build a 3D representation of the ground. That gives us a 3D point cloud, like you'd get from a laser scan. And from there, we can build digital elevation models. And we can, of course, do a big geo-referenced photo stitch. Now, the drone's GPS, sometimes depending on the type of drone you're flying, could be a meter precision. It could be 10 centimeters precision. But to make sure we're really accurate, we'll go and do an actual ground survey as well and tie in those data points to the drone to make sure that that's really tight. From that data, we'll have we have a software tool that will look at a scene, and we've built a machine learning system that will identify the different things that are out there. So let's say we want to look at erosion in an estuary. Instead of having a picture that's got millions and millions of different things in it, from little tufts of grass to logs, we'll have a computer vision software that will say, okay, this is the mud, this is grass, this is log, this is road, this is water, so that when we fly over multiple seasons or multiple years, we can see how the ecosystem is changing and shifting. We can identify where invasive species are and how many as well. The second thing we do is fly a drone that has a laser scanner on it called LiDAR. LiDAR stands for light detection and ranging. It's a sensor that shoots out 360,000 pulses a second. These lasers, they bounce off things, come back to the sensor. How long it takes them to go and come back tells us the position of things, how far they are from the drone. From that, we have a tool that will break down this cloud of tens or hundreds of millions of points, and it can do the same type of classification as we can with photogrammetry. But since we're using lasers instead of just visible light, we can go through leaf cover and see the trunks of trees. So we can then use this as a tool for counting trees, for measuring the growth, and for doing different kinds of forest studies to see how, for example, different replanting strategies in clear cuts have different success under different conditions. We can try and optimize forest management for having healthy future forests.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, do you take more than one sort of snapshot, like today, or do you analyze it over a period of time? What's your time references for these things?
It depends on what the client's interested in. We do a lot of monitoring and a lot of restoration planning support. So for monitoring, we'd go out once a year or maybe once a season, once every 3 months or so, and provide images and elevation models of how a site changes. So this is a way of measuring erosion, of measuring the presence of different species, say the progression of invasive species or the success of invasive species removal, for example. For restoration, what we'll do is we'll go and build a model of a site, and then we'll have this digital model that represents at really fine scale, say 5 centimeter resolution or better, of a big maybe 100, 150 hectare conservation area. We'll use this to support our conservation partners in planning restoration. Maybe it's breaking a dike to restore a coastal wetland or salt marsh. They'll go in and do a construction using this map as a base, and then we'll go and do an after image to show exactly what they've done. So it's a way of validating and showing the work that's been done, making sure that what's on the ground corresponded to what they planned. And then over time, we can continue to monitor it to see how the work that they did on the ground is taken by natural processes and reformed into, say, a salt marsh or a wetland or whatever it was that they were trying to restore.
Now, what does this process eliminate or replicate? you talk about people on the ground and vast amount of data to be researched. So what is it that this system is replacing?
Well, I'll give you an example of a project I did in an ecological reserve in Delta, BC. So there's this area that has three different types of invasive species in it, and they wanted to map this. So they hired, this is the regional district, hired a team of summer students who would go out and walk through the ecologically sensitive area with a GPS recorder and a notebook. They would see something like reed canary grass, and they'd say, okay, it is right down the coordinates at this location. It's about 10 meters by 5 meters. Okay, walk to the next place. Okay, here's a blackberry bush. It's about 10 meters long by 2 meters deep and right down the coordinates. And so what you have is a lot of people walking through a sensitive site, taking notes on paper. You get back to the office, you open up the notepad, open up a GIS program, and you start manually entering all these things and drawing shapes that approximate where all these different species are. So it's very, very time consuming. It's reasonably accurate, and you have a lot of boots on the ground walking through a site. What we did was came in and flew a drone. We didn't have to enter the site. The drone flew over, built a map. We had high resolution images of about 1 centimeter per pixel where we could see all the reed canary grass, all the blackberry, and then we can identify with our machine learning algorithm, which plants are where. Other ones where there's, you know, shadows and stuff, we can just draw in by hand. And we get, in much less time, a much more accurate map of where invasive species are in that site without a lot of boots on the ground walking through a sensitive area. Mm-hmm. So we're able to save between tens and, if it's a big enough site, even hundreds of hours and all the cost, while reducing the physical impact on site. And that allows our partners to go out and then do more. If they've got a limited budget, they can only do, you know, 100 hectares in, they can only classify 100 hectares in a year. If they're using drones, either themselves or by hiring us, we can support their drone processing to save time. They can do a lot more with their budgets and make a lot bigger impact on the ground, or put more money into invasive species removal, for example, once they know it's there.
You don't do all this by yourself. You've got a team. So tell me about the Smart Shores team. Who have you got working with you?
I have a great data scientist that helps all these things happen. I've partnered with the Pacific Institute for Mathematical Sciences, and I've hired one of their recent graduates, Felix, who's a brilliant machine learning and classification guy. He's been working on building the tools that say, you know, what's in a site or how many trees they are, how much carbon they're sequestering. I work with a lot of students on an intern basis for helping build out the kind of the edges of these projects. And I've just recently started working with a biotech lab that's working on building new biosensors to try and create a cheaper way of measuring certain persistent coastal pollutants like hydrocarbons. So we can go out into a site and we can combine the drone data with the pollution tests on the ground to try and get really comprehensive maps of where pollutants are within a site without paying for a lot of expensive tests. By combining the two, we can save time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what geographic area do you work with?
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, we work a lot in British Columbia, so all up and down the coast, Vancouver Island and the mainland. We've been doing some work in Alberta and in Manitoba, but now that we're developing more and more on the software end, we're starting to work all throughout Canada, and we're looking to expand into different markets throughout the world. People who have drones want to benefit from what we provide for in terms of data classification or processing. We work with them to develop a flight plan, and then they can fly, take the pictures, send them to us, and then we'll give them back these data products to help save their time and save them time and allow them to get more out of their actual environmental management budget. So they're not spending their time measuring and classifying, they're spending their time making a difference, restoring and conserving.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just concluded a successful Kickstarter program to help fund one of the ventures that you were looking at. Tell us a little about that, the Coastal Pollution Mapper, and why did you turn to Kickstarter for funding?
Yeah, that project was a lot of fun. The reason it started was there's a great organization called MEOPAR, which is a federal grant agency for research here in Canada. They started a project called Phasm Fund, which in a nutshell is if someone goes out and they crowdfund money, Phasm Fund will quadruple it as long as it's for scientific research and it's spent through university. And so we got on board with them as their first pilot project in crowdfunded science. And so what I wanted to do was take this coastal pollution mapper and see if we can't raise interest from people who could benefit from it and then leverage that with this this MEOPAR Phasm Fund money and then provide an example of crowdfunded science and how this can make a difference on the ground beyond just supporting graduate student research, which is the main use for crowdfunding, to see if we could try and get some kind of community-led initiative. So I had an idea to do this coastal pollution mapper, which is using drones and biosensors to measure pollutants in the coast, but it's a pretty obscure topic. And so I had to do a lot of talking, a lot of shopping to find a place where this might be useful. And we settled on the Little Campbell River, which is an important area because it's in a very urban watershed. It has five local environmental groups who are interested in conserving it because it's on a major migratory bird route. It has a salmon hatchery and it has habitat for forage fish. It drains into the Salish Sea, which is the home of an endangered killer whale population, the southern resident killer whales, who are suffering from extra shipping traffic and also from absorbing pollutants. And it's within the traditional territory of the Semiahmoo First Nation, whose shellfish fishery has been closed since the 1970s due to contamination. And so I worked with my team and these groups to tailor a project that would fit their needs exactly, which is helping to test contaminants in the soil so that the Semiahmoo Nation can reopen their fishery, and helping support the hatchery in providing cleaner spawning habitat for their fish, when at the same time, we're helping to support the coastal flood adaptation strategy of a nearby municipality by saying, hey, you know, if we raise this road, if we dredge this river, are there contaminants in there that might be resuspended and go back into the environment? And so we worked on this crowdfunding campaign, trying to raise all the money, and there was some interest. We raised $12,600. A little over $2,000 came from just organic donations that flowed in from the web, but over $10,000 was from going out and talking to people in the community and shaking hands and saying, you know, we can make a difference cleaning up this area. Here's why it's important. And so it wasn't a traditional crowdfunding project in that we're selling a product and a lot of people are coming in from all aspects of life. It was really a community-driven product that leveraged the crowd and then leveraged this MEOPAR money to create a real kind of grassroots research initiative.
You raised money both through the kickstarting but also by going around knocking on doors. You raised a certain amount of money, and then a federal agency, as you say, quadrupled that donation. Do you see this as a model for future funding for research?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we spend billions of dollars every year on scientific funding, and we do that because science has the potential to make our lives better. And we put a lot of trust, and rightfully so, in the people who are doing research, and the academic sector produces a lot of value for communities. But especially over the past decade, people have been feeling, people more, economically centered and on the right of the political spectrum, have been feeling alienated from science, that it's this pastime of elites, or it doesn't speak to them, or that maybe, you know, climate change is just some kind of scam or something. And I think crowdfunding is a way to connect people with science and to show that science is something that belongs to everyone and that connects communities and universities to help support people meeting real needs on the ground. And what crowdfunding can do is force researchers to come out of this kind of academic bubble, it can be a little insular, and go out in the community and say, here's what I'm thinking for research. Is this important to you? How could it be changed? And be more consultative and help build projects that are supported by the community to try and engage more people in science. So if we took just a fraction of the billions of dollars, even a few percent, that's given to research and said, you can have this on condition you crowdfund some minimum amount, I think it would help open a public debate around the role of science in society and help restore some of the trust that's maybe been lost in the polarity we've seen over the past decade.
It sounds like a great idea to engage the public, one, but also monitor their interest in a particular project, as you say, and then that demonstrates to the larger funding organizations, specifically government, to say, maybe you should consider this rather than the traditional scientific model of university-based research grants and things like that. But you do think it's going to continue? Do you think the Canadian government is going to continue with this kind of funding?
Well, the Phylum Fund will continue for at least another few years. There's two more projects that will be coming out soon. So if someone is so inclined, they can go to phylum.fund to see any new projects when they come up. There is some interest from other non-marine granting agencies. The Phylum Fund is focused on marine research. So my hope and the hope of the team at Phylum Fund is that we can work to expand this idea to try and bring a democratic form of science. It's not totally democratic that you have to pay, but I think, there's no model is perfect, but I think the beauty of crowdfunding is in an era of social media when it's so easy to just hit like on Instagram and scroll past, even if you donate a dollar, you have to stop, get off the couch, go get your wallet, put in your credit card information. It takes time. And I think that really shows that people are willing to go the extra mile, and it really helps vet projects to really, really get a good sense of what it is that people really find important.
Now, in this last project that you're working on, you're still working on it, I believe, that you engaged with the indigenous communities. What was that like? How did you have to approach that? How willing were they to work with you?
Well, this project is in the Little Campbell, is on the traditional territory of the Semiahmoo First Nation. So I wanted to make sure that I spoke with them and had their permission to use their traditional territory as a study site. They've experienced quite a lot of problems over the past 150 years of people taking their land and polluting their resources and trying to force them to assimilate into a different society. So I think now that our society is recognizing that more and moving towards reconciliation, it's very important to do that, especially when federal funds are being used. And just as an individual person, if you're going to go do work in a big farmer's field, you ask the farmer for permission for First Nations. When a big bay or coastal area is a part of their traditional territory, it should really be no different. And so I spoke with them and said, here's what I'm looking to do. How can this help you? How can I change this to make sure that there's some benefit to you since it is your land? And that's when they'd mentioned that, we've been, since time immemorial, harvesting shellfish from right out front of our territory, right out in the intertidal area. But since the 70s, it's been closed because the city came in and all the runoff, or the city developed, the runoff flowed into the bay and polluted it. And they have a really interesting point right now, because Semiahmoo Bay is right on the Canada-US border. It's a reasonably small bay with a border going right through the middle. And about 10 or 15 years ago, the U.S. side reopened for shell fishing. And so the Semiahmoo members who live in Washington State can go out and harvest. The Canadian side can't. And it's not necessarily because it's so polluted. It's because nobody's retested to see. Canada has by far the longest coastline in the world. There's lots of stuff to test for and measure. And there's a tenth of the budget that there is in the U.S. is a tenth of the population and a tenth of the tax base. And so I get that, people can't test all the time. But, for whatever reason, right or wrong, it hasn't been tested. So what we discussed with them was developing some kind of comprehensive tests that can give them the information to go to the Department of Fisheries and Oceans and say, hey, here's what's in our site. It's fine. You should reclassify it so we can fish. Or here's what's in our site. These two pollutants are still unsafe, so let's work with the municipalities to eliminate them. And so I needed to make sure that we had a really rigorous model for this kind of testing, since it's you know, for food people will eat. So I spoke with the Vancouver Aquarium and their parent organization, Oceanwide, which had been doing really full spectrum comprehensive tests on hundreds of pollutants throughout the BC coast. And I got their framework for testing, the lab that they use, and we're going to spend about $20,000 of the $50,000 budget for this project, doing comprehensive testing within the bay and the shellfish to identify what kind of pollutants there are so that we can have a clear roadmap for the next steps the Semiahmoo can take to reopen their fishery.
Well, that ties in with food sovereignty, especially for that nation to be able to look at what is, as you say, right in their backyard and be able to make access of it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you brought up food sovereignty, because it's not about security. It's not about going to the store and just buying food. It's about the people's rights to harvest food that is appropriate to them, that helps tie in with their culture. And I think that's something that's been missing for 40 years. And you've got kids who've grown up into adults who have never gone out and harvested fish right in front of their house, right? It's a shame.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how people can find out more. What can they do to connect with you and your exciting program?
Well, I would, you know, if people want to get in touch, people can reach out to me at my website is smartshores.ca, or you can follow my company and this crowdfunded science project over the next year on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SmartShores. I'd be really happy to speak with anyone one-on-one, or just to show through video and images the kinds of work that we're doing to try and help make our coasts cleaner, healthier places for everyone.
Nathan Vadeboncour, President and Founder of Smart Shores, thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters.
Thank you very much for having me.